This is I Choose Life News and Views, sponsored by Indiana Right to Life and Right to Life of Northeast Indiana, committed to defending innocent human life for all people of all ages. Your hosts are Kathy Humbarger, Abigail Lorenzen, and Scott Kump.
Welcome to I Choose Life News and Views. I'm Kathy Humbarger.
I'm Abigail Lorenzen.
And I'm Scott Kump. I Choose Life News and Views is produced by Bot Radio Network in Fort Wayne in cooperation with Indiana Right to Life, as well as Right to Life of Northeast Indiana.
And now, the pro-life news.
April is National Volunteer Month, and the pro-life movement thrives on volunteers, from legislative efforts to educational programs to pregnancy centers and more. Thanks to all of you who donate your time so that others may live.
In this segment, we're going to talk to a very, very good friend. Representative Christy Stutzman represents District 49 here in Indiana, and we are going to be talking about the whole COVID-19 crisis and how it has impacted the life issues. So, Representative Stutzman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
Well, we've been on the battlefield once or twice before together, so this has been another one of those times. So when this whole COVID crisis broke and the governor began issuing executive orders, it really wasn't clear how all of this fit together in terms of abortions and whether they were able to continue taking place during the lockdown or if there was some kind of a special category for them. So tell me what you were thinking when you started considering if the abortion industry was impacted here in Indiana by any of the COVID-19 executive orders.
Yeah, when we first were, given the information, of course, there was a lot of unknowns at that time. And so there's a lot of scurrying to gather information and any type of data we could look at to figure out what this was going to look like and what the order was going to be. You know, because we are not in session as a legislative body, we weren't really given a whole lot of heads up as far as what would constitute the first executive order. We were told kind of after the fact as far as what the governor had decided to do. And as a legislative body, we really didn't have any sway on that other than our leadership was being advised and brought into some of the meetings, and we were told afterwards what was happening. So we were kind of watching with everyone else to figure out how the order was going to be presented and what was going to be the content of the order. I frankly was pretty surprised at how comprehensive it was. Although, when you look at our surrounding states, it wasn't quite as sweeping as the others, but still, I felt like it was quite comprehensive for Indiana. And immediately, of course, as someone who was interested in the life issue, when I saw the fact that he was putting a stay on all the non-urgent, elective procedures in hospitals in order to prepare for a big influx is what they were being told was going to happen in our hospitals. And of course, I was looking to make sure that that included abortion facilities. According to our Indiana code, they are an elective procedure. So I was surprised to see that that was not specifically addressed, and that allows for some question marks to be there still, and that's why we first started taking action.
So this wasn't just a question coming from you. I think several of your colleagues were unclear too. So the first attempt that you made to get clarification came from a bunch of legislators. Tell us a little bit about the content of the letter that questioned how this impacted abortions and what action you took.
Yeah, I mean, we started seeing that there was no end of their operations, and yet all of our hospitals and ERs and things like that were well on their way to stopping all procedures that were not elective. And so we immediately started talking amongst each other, legislators to each other, saying, if this is comprehensive, then it should cover abortion clinics too. And if PPE is in such high demand, then it's all hands on deck. And so we need to contact the governor and say, hey, your order isn't really clear on this and it needs to be clarified. And also we were, sending him information as far as what our Indiana code says regarding it. So we started talking to each other and started trying to figure out a way to work with pro-life groups and make sure we had all of our ducks in a row as far as like what was happening on the ground, and then get the information to him and ask him to clarify in his next executive order exactly what was covered and what wasn't. And so we got a good list of legislators together. It was over 80 legislators that signed onto it on both the House and the Senate side asking the governor to clarify.
And we were delighted after that, at least I was, to learn that the governor did, in fact, include abortion businesses in his list. So for that, we're grateful. But there was a sentence that immediately followed, including abortion providers in this comprehensive list, that was troubling. And that is where the abortion industry chose to hang their hat. So tell us a little bit about who determines, according to the executive order, if
right.
a procedure is essential or not.
Yes, there was a sentence added to it that said that it was up to the doctor's discretion to decide whether it was needful or not. And that gave them enough wiggle room to be able to say, well, you know, every abortion is necessary, and so we're going to continue. And, you know, we were disappointed to see that. And we knew that that would be the case. That would be the reaction on the abortion side of it. And so that was something that was added that we were trying to figure out, you know, how to handle and what to address with that situation, because that was something that, even though they were specifically saying that abortion was included in that list, they gave a little caveat there, which made it difficult.
And a story of unintended consequences that's just heartbreaking happened in Fort Wayne as a result of this. Representative Stutzman, I know you know the pro-life family that experienced a tragedy as a result of this executive order. What happened is the father, the husband in the family, had a back situation. He needed back surgery.
Right.
But he was unable to get it because it was determined to be elective. And he was immobile because of the pain and developed a blood clot and passed away, sadly. So
yeah.
Here, someone who really needed to have this particular surgery done could not get to his doctor because the office was closed down completely and in very short order was no longer with us. So that was really heartbreaking.
Yeah, very heartbreaking. And your heart goes out to them, and it's such a tragedy, you know, shouldn't have happened. And I know they're struggling with that right now. And I know the community has surrounded them and supported them. But, you know, my mind goes also to my own father, who is not doing well and is in failing health and needs a procedure and was postponed for 4 weeks because of this whole
right.
thing and needing this very badly in order to be able to survive, and yet put on the back burner. And we're seeing that over and over and over again with people who desperately need procedures
right.
who are being forced to wait too long, and then it has unintended consequences. And, you know, that's the danger that we're facing right now. And yet it's really very sad and disheartening to see the fact that our people on the ground, sidewalk counselors and folks, are seeing just an influx of business at the abortion clinics
right.
and no stop there. They're full force ahead. And not just that, but they're asking for PPE supplies and other things boldly, you know, out in public on social media, requesting, these abortion clinics are requesting, you know, help and donations and things like that during a time when people are suffering and waiting on much needed procedures. It's just very, very wrong.
Right. And that doesn't even count the women that could very well be exposed to the COVID-19 virus by going into that facility.
Right.
So there's that to consider as well. So the governor responded by including abortion in, I think that went into effect April 1st, if I recall correctly, with the sentence that gave the abortion providers the room that they needed to continue and claim they were complying with the governor's order. But then I began being contacted by healthcare providers, and I know you were too, Representative Stutzman, healthcare providers across the state who were very concerned about this. So
yeah.
as I recall, then a second letter went to the governor from the healthcare providers. What happened with that?
Right. So I think there were over 80 that ended up signing on to that letter as
mm-hmm.
well. Very much concerned about the ongoing operations when anything emergency related was being told to go to the hospital. There was no reason for these facilities to be open, and yet they were continuing and putting more people at risk, like you said. So there were a lot of doctors who signed on to this letter asking the governor to please clarify whether abortion clinics could remain open during this time when all these other clinics were closing and everything was being forced to the hospitals and ERs and ICUs, because that's where they were most prepared. So they did send the request to the governor. We have confirmation that he received it. And I believe he was even asked at a press conference about it.
Yes.
And the lawyer, I believe, was one that answered the question and said that they felt that they had to put that language in. And that was the end of it. I don't know that they really elaborated at all after that letter was sent from the doctors.
Well, I know you know Indiana code better than I do. However, there is in the Indiana code a definition of an emergency abortion, and it
right.
It doesn't seem to line up with the executive order. So there is still some confusion, and you weren't exactly satisfied with the responses that you got from your letter or the healthcare providers to their letter. So thank you so much for being persistent. What was the next step you took?
So in an emergency situation like we were facing, I really felt like we needed the attorney general to weigh in and say, okay, is this enforceable? Can we put a stop to some of these actions? I mean, if lives are at risk here, not just through abortion, but through exposure to COVID-19 and not following protocol and also not sending people to the hospital when we're truly in an emergency situation. What can the attorney general do under the verbiage that has been passed in these executive orders? Mm-hmm. Are there actions he could take? And so I talked to several legislator friends, and we decided, yes, and we talked to pro-life people. We talked to you and to others and said, okay, maybe we should ask for clarification and see what's possible here from the attorney general. So that's what we did. We sent a letter to the attorney general and also sent him a copy of the letter from the healthcare professionals and just ask him to weigh in and just to ask, you know, what can be done? What is in your purview and under the current executive order, what's possible to do? So right now we're waiting on a response from him to tell us what is possible. But I think at this point, the overall experience has been kind of a roller coaster of realizing that it wasn't, you know, this was not addressed, trying to get an answer. When the answer comes back, it was not clear enough. Mm-hmm. And so there was a loophole there allowed, and really abortions have continued, you know, throughout this whole thing. And that, and I think that is the saddest part of all.
Absolutely. Well, we attempted to delay recording this week's program. And as we record this on Friday before it begins to air tomorrow on Saturday, we were hoping to have the Attorney General's determination. If that comes in and there's some way that we can include this information or get it out to our listeners, we will certainly do that. So at a minimum, we'll have an update next week in our I Choose Life News and Views segment, staying on top of the coronavirus and everything that is happening as it impacts the abortion industry. So thank you so much, Representative Stutzman, for just hanging in there and being tenacious and not giving up when many people would have after time and time again of making an inquiry. So this is not the first time, Representative Stutzman, that I've seen you stick to your position and be willing to defend it and push ahead and do the right thing at the right time for the right reason. So I just want you to know how much we appreciate you and your voice in the State House, and not only in the State House, but other times like this when the legislature isn't in session. We look forward to being on the battlefield with you many more times ahead, and I just can't tell you how much we appreciate you.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been an honor to work with you over the years, and it's an honor to fight for life because every life matters, and we won't give up until we come face to face with the Lord and we can give an account for what we've done. But while we're here, you know, we can do what we can. So I'm glad to help.
It seems we've dedicated the entire month of April to addressing the ways that the culture of death is ignoring or even exploiting the coronavirus crisis. We've spent most of that time talking about the abortion industry, but should also beware the push that some will make or are already making for the expansion of euthanasia. Victims may be targeted either actively or passively based on age, disability, or other arbitrary criteria. To prevent this, National Right to Life has recently urged those in the highest levels of federal leadership to protect the vulnerable among us. I'm Scott Kump, and today on I Choose Life News and Views, I've asked Jennifer Popick, Legislative Director of National Right to Life, to join us over the phone. She'll tell us what's going on, what she and her colleagues are doing about it, and what you can do about it. Welcome, Jennifer.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, tell us about National Right to Life.
Sure. National Right to Life is the oldest and largest grassroots pro-life organization in the country. And we're unique among, you know, you think of the big DC groups, we're unique in that we have an affiliate in every state and often many affiliates of those affiliates. And so we're really a grassroots ground up sort of organization. And in addition to abortion, which you would associate our fight with, we have long dealt with the issue of euthanasia, of rationing healthcare, those sorts of things as well.
So Indiana Right to Life would be one of your affiliates.
That's correct.
All right. So on to this discussion of euthanasia, in particular related to this whole coronavirus pandemic. Like I said, the culture of death, they do not miss a trick. One of the passive ways to target the elderly or disabled is to simply withhold medical care. Has there already been a push for this related to the current pandemic?
Well, what we've seen is interesting. You know, if you think of sort of the abortion element, I think that the other side, the pro-abortion side, has a very like concerted effort to use this as an excuse to expand things like, you know, at-home abortions or mail order abortions or loosening regulations, things like that. But what I think, you know, there's always been voices on the far left saying that we ought to prioritize resources, but we've never been in a situation, you know, where resources had become scarce. And so several weeks ago, I had friends in not the pro-life circle, but in other circles contacting us and saying, are you following what's going on in Italy? And what was going on in Italy was that they were just putting these sort of top-down, no person over a certain age is getting treatment at all if they walk into an emergency room. And this sort of thing became shocking, you know, coupled with sort of that already existing body of literature that exists in the United States about rationing resources to people with disabilities, to people over a certain age, to people with certain conditions. And so we had this on the radar. And then what we saw was a series of states becoming very fearful. They weren't going to have access to enough ventilators, to enough equipment. And they started to sort of talk about an issue, very frightening rationing policies. And so that's when we got involved.
So to your knowledge, no states have actually implemented this type of rationing, right? Yet?
That's correct. That's the good thing. Now, we have a lot of state, you know, there's states that have issued guidance, some of which was existing old guidance that they've now sought to revise. We've had individual hospital systems try to put out guidance, but right now we're in a position where I think there was an incredibly strong effort to get ventilators, to get personal protective equipment out, particularly ventilators, out to hospital systems. So we've seen a lot of complaints filed to the federal government. I don't have an exact number for you, but we've seen a great number of complaints filed that some of the policies that hospitals or states have laid out are discriminatory, but we haven't, you know, we're not to the point yet where the ventilators aren't keeping up with demand.
Has the normal euthanasia crowd, the cheerleaders of that movement, have they been pushing for this type of rationing as far as you know?
I think they're deliberately staying a little quiet during this round because they like to push, you know, the people like you think of Compassion and Choices or the Death with Dignity people, those sorts of groups. And what they really promote is, you know, on its face, rationing only, you know, they only promote euthanasia, rather, for people who are asking for it. And that's how they sort of get the nose under the tent, as it were. They have a strong record of saying, like, oh, sure, we're promoting assisted suicide here or, you know, voluntary cessation of treatment here. But it's only for people who are really asking for it. And, of course, we know that it'll never be able to be confined in the way that they're presenting it. So I think that they're being, you know, a little bit deliberately quiet now because this isn't their strategy, but I don't see them in any way pushing back on, like, this notion of people with disabilities or people who were never asking to be killed. You know, I'd like to see their voice in this, but they've been silent sort of all around.
You mentioned people who ask for it, and I don't know whether the following has happened yet in this particular crisis, but rationed healthcare tends to lead to scenarios where the self-appointed gatekeepers say things like, you don't qualify for that life-saving treatment, but you do qualify for this suicide cocktail.
Yeah, you've got that exactly right. It's simply sort of pretty dressing, you know, saying someone might choose it, but of course, it never ends up that way. People are pushed into it. People are denied treatment or given essentially death sentences against their will. That's how these things sort of play out. You can't confine it to only people who are, quote unquote, asking for an early death. So it never plays out that way. And it always ends up sweeping in vulnerable groups. Those who have less ability to speak for themselves, those with disabilities, the elderly, people who aren't always effective advocates for themselves.
I'm Scott Kump. I'm speaking with Jennifer Popick. She is the legislative director of National Right to Life. We're talking about the at least potential specter of euthanasia during this coronavirus crisis. Before we go any farther, Jennifer, maybe you should give us National Right to Life's contact information where people can go and get more information about this and a lot of other topics?
Sure. Our main website is a good portal. It's nrlc.org. And we also have a daily news site up that I think is sort of your latest up-to-date, and that's nationalrighttolifenews.com or .org. And so I think those are your two best places to go. The news especially gives you up-to-date daily information.
Speaking of the website, I did read an article from there talking about the push to impose do not resuscitate orders on vulnerable people, some of the vulnerable types we've talked about, elderly, disabled, et cetera, even to the point of contradicting existing advanced directives. Do you know anything about that?
For sure. We've seen efforts in several states, and some have been walked back and some have been promoted, so I won't give you a punch down of states. But what it is instituting do not resuscitate orders against the wishes of a patient or a family sort of across the board. And the notion here is that there will be no effort made to resuscitate them, and then the ventilator could be given to somebody else. And I think this is really frightening because this is sort of a push we've seen. We've had a lot of friends in the disability rights community saying that in a lot of places that treat exclusively people with disabilities, significant disabilities, they're often given DNRs without their consent. And this is just truly one of these notions of rationing at its worst. I think, you know, the fact that they would be unilateral, meaning the patient would have no say in them. And frankly, you know, the thing that we hear from a lot of healthcare providers, I have a brother who's an ICU nurse, so I worry about him every day, but he tells me that, and this is not uncommon, a do not resuscitate order means that when your heart stops, when you stop breathing, you know, certain efforts are not taken to revive you. But frequently these DNR orders are viewed as a do not treat order, and that's very different and very dangerous. So in addition to these sort of DNR orders being problematic, the notion that we'd have just a widespread push should, I think, frighten everybody.
Yeah, if there's a slippery slope, they will take us down it. And as we're talking about concerns, and legitimate concerns, let's be honest, about the possibility of limited supplies, limited medical facilities, I'm going to go on a rant. And again, we're steering this back to the topic of abortion, because why should abortion facilities be allowed to operate in these situations where they are using up those materials, and then you're going to turn around and use those limited materials or the lack of those materials as justification for killing even more people?
Right. Planned Parenthood, for example, has put up on a lot of their websites, please donate if you have any masks or any sort of equipment at home so we can continue to do abortions in the face of what we see as clear directives from governors and attorneys general to not do elective surgery. I think it's just shocking that not only would they be putting women at risk in this way, but taking supplies from people in an urgent crisis situation.
I'm Scott Kump. You're listening to I Choose Life News and Views. I'm speaking with Jennifer Popick. She is the legislative director of National Right to Life. We're talking about concerns about euthanasia, and more accurately, rationing in light of this coronavirus crisis. Now, Jennifer, what action have you taken, and what action has National Right to Life taken in response to these concerns?
When we first saw the early reports, not only coming in from overseas, but I think the panic that had taken hold at many hospital systems and in many states, we had urged that federal law ought to be adhered to here, specifically the Americans with Disabilities Act, specifically, although we might have a lot of problems on the abortion front with, and even to some degree the rationing front on the Obamacare law, there was protections put in that bill as well that said your degree of disability, your medical dependency, and specifically also your age, but in your quality of life, that these couldn't be criteria for taking away your care. We don't want a situation where a hospital says someone's in a wheelchair, I mean, and it could get draconian as this, or somebody is oxygen dependent. And, you know, they might have a very high quality of life if they described it. But, you know, when it just looks like statistics on a piece of paper, these are the people who are going to be denied care. You know, there might be an incredibly vibrant 75-year-old giving to their community, or not even, but like who is the government to sort of come in and put their thumb on the scale and say, you know, this life is worth saving and this one isn't. So we saw this move afoot. And so we asked sort of existing federal law that we felt it would be helpful if Health and Human Services, particularly the Office of Civil Rights, would put out guidance just reminding hospitals and states of their duties here under the law, that, you know, understand if resources did become scarce, there are other ways to figure out who gets these resources, such as, you know, your ability to truly survive. In the case of other things, maybe you just have to go to a lottery system. These are very frightening things to think about. But it shouldn't just be the sort of top line, okay, you have a disability or your life's not worth living anyhow. So I had written a letter to the president, to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and urged them to put out this guidance, which about 2 weeks ago they did on a Friday. It's a little bit over 2 weeks ago here. And we think the guidance is good. And what it says is if you have complaints, to contact the Office of Civil Rights. And so that's what we're urging states to do. We have this fairly good top-down guidance reminding states they can't do this, reminding hospital systems they can't have these sort of blanket policies on disability, on age, on quality of life. And they're open now and they're taking complaints. And so if anyone in your state or in any other state who's listening hears of such a violation, or they see a hospital policy that would discriminate against them, or they know of someone who's been discriminated against, Office of Civil Rights is open and taking complaints, and that's an incredibly important step.
So we need to be diligent and on the lookout for that. By the way, I need to point out, we're recording this on Tuesday, the 14th of April. So when she says 2 weeks ago, that would have been early April, late March that the federal government did implement and start taking this action.
Yes.
So you want our listeners to be on the lookout if they hear of violations, to let people know. Any other action items for our listeners?
I think your action item is Congress is home until May 4th. And so if you have the ability to in some way talk to your member of Congress or your senator, please alert them that this is not an acceptable response, even in a pandemic, that we're hopeful to include language in any further packages, any of these rescue packages that go forward for the economy or for other things, that we're hopeful to include language that makes sure this sort of thing doesn't go on. So I would say if you talk to your member of Congress, please urge them that rationing is not an acceptable response to this. Let's get ventilators where we need them. Let's keep doing a good job distributing the sort of life-saving things, and that this can't just fall by the wayside. This is not acceptable. We're America.
One last time, what is your contact information for National Right to Life?
I'd recommend you go to the website and you could find some way to shoot an email and it'll get to me. It's nrlc.org.
Again, my guest today has been Jennifer Popick. She is the legislative director of National Right to Life, talking about euthanasia concerns and discrimination against the elderly and the disabled and things you can do to prevent that. Jennifer, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
You've been listening to I Choose Life News and Views. If you have questions about this program or if you'd like to support the fight for life, please call 260-471-1849 or go to ichooselife.org, because without the right to life, no other rights matter.